InfoWars.com studios. It's The Real News with your host, David Knight.
Welcome on this Monday, October the 1st, 2018. It is the one-year anniversary of the MGM Grand shooting, although that took place last year on a Sunday night. We're going to talk about the update to that. And of course, what's going to happen today. We're also going to talk about what happened on Saturday Night Live with Kanye West, or as he's now referring to himself, yay. That's what President Trump said, yay, when he heard what he had to say. We'll also give you an update on Elon Musk, and then we're going to take a look at NAFTA 2.0. Is this a good deal for the U.S. economically? Yes. Is it a good deal for the U.S. in terms of our sovereignty? I don't think so. We're going to talk about the EU globalists and how they are opposing the United States. You know, everybody was mocking President Trump when he went to NATO and treated the EU as enemies. And I'm going to show you what Macron and Merkel are doing, along with the people in Brussels, and I'll explain to you why they really are our enemies, why they have become the center for pushing globalism. And so the trilateral vision of Zbigniew Brzezinski moves forward. We still have the European superstate. We have China created as a superstate over Asia. And perhaps Canada's Justin Trudeau has fallen on the sword, putting his people's interest, short-term interest, sacrificing those to make certain that a long-term control over our sovereignty, that NAFTA and the trilateral nature of that, which is going to be the foundation for the North American Union, that is preserved, no matter what it costs his people. And he's willing to sacrifice that and allow President Trump to have a win economically. But we also have, when we look at budget deals that are put through over and over again by the Republicans, by the Democrats, they're always a short-term solution. Yes, we got our government refunded for a short period of time. We might have had a major tax cut, but if we don't take care of these structural problems of spending and of power that has been taken into Washington, then we are, in the long term, going to fall on the sword ourselves. And so we're going to take a look at that in terms of the short term and the longer term. We had an article that came out over the weekend, the father of the World Wide Web, and I'm not talking about Al Gore. I'm talking about the real guy who invented the World Wide Web, Tim Berners-Lee. Now, of course, what he did was he created the hypertext transfer protocol. That's where you see the HTTP. That's the web that sits on top of the internet structure. Of course, the internet itself was a DARPA creation, created by a DARPA psychologist. The idea was created. Of course, the practical implementation of all this started coming together in the late 1990s. I've talked about this many times, how DARPA, the Pentagon, the NSA, the CIA either created their own venture capital firms. In some cases, the CIA's Incutel was created about that time, or they made sure that their directors and high-ranking officials were present on the boards of the venture capital firms that were picking the winners and the losers that were going to be funded or not funded. People like Facebook and Google, Amazon, getting help from these venture capital firms. But now, Tim Berners-Lee, who created the superstructure, the World Wide Web, the HTTP protocol, has looked at this and he says he's very concerned about what's happened in the last two or three decades. I think we all are. Now, his solution is to come up with a more decentralized internet. And that truly is the solution. Will it be enough of a solution? Again, as we're looking at NAFTA, look at the pros and the cons of this. I believe that was the greatest thing of the internet, just like the personal computer decentralized power away from centralized mainframes and the big institutions that control those, put it in the hands of the people for a short period of time. But then through various devices and mechanisms, they were able to use those to intrude into our lives in all new ways. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm David Knight.
Found it. From the InfoWars.com studios in Austin, Texas, it's your host, David Knight.
Welcome on this Monday, October 1st, 2018. We're going to take a look real quickly in just a few minutes at the MGM shooting. 1 year later, we're going to take a look at what happened with Kanye West with Saturday Night Live, an update on Elon Musk, and we're going to look at NAFTA 2.0. But before we do that, let's take a look at Internet 2.0. This has been proposed by Tim Berners-Lee, the real inventor of the Internet, not Al Gore. And he said in an interview with Vanity Fair last month, he said, "I was devastated going through, as he did on the interview, a litany of harmful, dangerous developments over the past 3 decades of the web." And this is a story that was on Drudge over the weekend. I don't know if you saw it. It was at the top of Drudge for a while. Internet 2.0. And I think it's a good thing if we do that. Now, what he did was he didn't, as I said at the top of the hour, he did not create the Internet. That was created by DARPA psychologists. That might give you a clue as what their intention was for the Internet. What he did was he created a practical structure, the World Wide Web, the HTTP protocol for client and server. And he's seen this hijacked by the people who created the substrate to hijack your privacy, to hijack what you're thinking, and to hijack how they control the herd mentality and do it not only just with the kind of broadcast propaganda that they've done in the past, but being able to get full feedback to see how well their propaganda is working on you. That's the real purpose of the Internet. We need to understand that, and hopefully, and I agree with his and support and applaud him for working to radically decentralize the Internet. Decentralization is always the solution. It really is. It's when things become centralized that they cease to function or that they become authoritarian. And so this is always going to be an ongoing fight of measures, countermeasures, countermeasures, and so forth. This is a war, folks. It is an information war at its heart. And the Internet is the center of that information war. So this is a necessary counterstep to the developments that we have received here. And our salvation here on this earth is going to come from these people who are going to fight back against the control structures and the technology being created by the military-industrial complex. It's going to be the individuals who are outside of that, fighting back against it, that are really going to be the ones more effective. We're not going to get any help from the politicians. You can forget about them. That's a vain hope to think that we're going to elect these people, go to the center of that corrupt cesspool we call Washington, D.C., and not be corrupted, not be compromised, not be marginalized, painted into a corner. They have all these different ways. If they can't corrupt you, they will isolate you in Washington, D.C. What we have to do is isolate them. We have to decentralize power. That means politically as well as the power of information has to be decentralized. And so what he has done is he's launched a startup that he says intends to end the dominance of Facebook, Google, Amazon, while in the process letting individuals take back control of their own data. He's got a new online platform. He's created a new company called Inrupt, I-N-R-U-P-T. He describes it as a personal online data store or a pod where everything from messages, music, contacts, other personal data will be stored in one place overseen by the user. Now, here's my caution on all of this. This is all coming out same weekend. We just had Facebook publicly hacked. 50 million to 90 million accounts hacked. If you remember, we've had the CIA hacked. We've had the NSA hacked. We've had the Pentagon hacked. We've had the Federal Reserve hacked. I could go on. Banks and so forth. Nobody is secure. And of course, William Binney, the former technical head of the NSA, spent decades there. I recall one of the interviews I talked to him. I said, "So what's the best way to encrypt your stuff for privacy?" He says, "There's no such thing as privacy. Anything that you put on a computer, anything that you put on the Internet is never going to be private. Get over that. Fantasy." So that's the downside of this. I mean, you need to understand that although we applaud his efforts to decentralize the web, you can never truly trust anything. That you can't trust the computer, can't trust your Internet for privacy. President Trump knows this. He said, if you got something important, put it on a piece of paper. Ed Balls knows this. And if you don't know who Ed Balls is here in America, he was the highest ranking individual to lose re-election after Bilderberg in 2014, I think, in Copenhagen. Now, I don't know if it had anything to do with it. I kind of think that it did. It got some attention in the UK. He was the Labour shadow secretary for the Exchequer. In other words, it's like the Secretary of the Treasury here in the US. And in the UK, the opposition party creates a shadow cabinet. So they have a person in the opposition party that is the person that would be in that position if they were in power instead of being the number two party. And so as this person who is supposedly like the Secretary of the Treasury for the Democrats, then, you know, oh, we're on the side of the working man, yet he's going to Bilderberg and meeting with his people. And even worse, we reported, my wife got great pictures of him as he was trying to get into a side entrance into Bilderberg, didn't have his badge. They asked him for his papers to get in. He started fumbling through his rolling suitcase. And as he did, it opened up. And the contents spilled out. No aftershave lotion, no breath freshener, no clothes, nothing but paper. The entire suitcase filled with paper. Because why? Because these people understand, just as President Trump does, that if you got something important, you don't put it on your computer. And you don't put it on the internet, of all places. And you don't ever trust any of this stuff. Ed Balls is going to that meeting that, you know, just a little get together there at Bilderberg. He was going to that meeting with a suitcase filled with paperwork, a suitcase full of papers. And so I would suggest to you, I applaud the idea that we're going to work to decentralize the internet, that we work to get around these companies that have been established by the Pentagon, DARPA, CIA people and their venture capital firms. I applaud that. Make no mistake about it, but, and we have to do, as he said, we have to do it now. This is an historical moment. We have to do this. We have to push back against this. We have to delay them. Nevertheless, don't allow yourself to put your trust into something like this. He says one idea that he's working on is a way to create a decentralized version of Alexa, Amazon's increasingly ubiquitous digital assistant. He calls his Charlie. Unlike Alexa, on Charlie, people would own all their own data. For example, health records, children's school events, or financial records. See, the real threat, however, is not simply that Google and Amazon and Facebook are going to monetize your data. The real threat is that anybody can get to that data. And the real threat is really coming from the government. Yes, Google and Facebook are partnering with the government. We have a fascist public-private partnership, but make no mistake about it. It's the government that can throw you in jail. They can rob you blind, but the government will falsely accuse you of being a terrorist or an enemy of the state because of your political or religious beliefs. That's where this is ultimately headed. And of course, they will be partnered with Amazon and Facebook and Google and YouTube and so forth in doing all of this. But if you're going to put all of your health records, all of your financial records, all this other stuff on one site and trust that because now we've got a new and improved decentralized a new piece of application, that would be a fool's errand. However, it would be a good way to break the power of some of these control structures that are working in a private-public partnership with the government, and I applaud that. His plans would impact billion-dollar business models that profit off of control over data. It is not likely that the big powers of the web will give up control without a fight. That's what they said in the interview. And he said, however, we are not asking their permission. Good for him. Good for him. It is important to fight back against these people. And, of course, we have George Gilder, also another article linked on the Drudge Report, a summary of the book that he has put out that I've talked to Joseph Farah about at length. And it's a life or internet after Google. Yes, they are going to go the way of the trash heap because of their centralized socialist mindset. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I have one more thing to say in terms of censorship and control of the internet. It's kind of interesting that we had Governor Brown in California do the right thing for once. Maybe not for fully the right reason, but yeah, he did the right thing. Let's give him credit. He vetoed a fake news bill. Now, this is something that was pushed in California, authored by none other than Senator Richard Pan. Now, for people in California who have fought against his mandatory vaccination bill, this guy is an authoritarian, and he has earned a reputation outside of California. But people in California know him pretty well. There isn't anything that this guy will not do. He's a doctor, but his authoritarian urges extend beyond his medical opinions to his opinions about what news is and truth and the government's role in determining that. And so they had created a bill. This is an article from the New American. They have an excellent coverage of this. Came out over the weekend. Richard Pan in California. Richard Pan. This is described. This bill directs the Attorney General to establish an advisory group to study the problem of the spread of false information through internet-based social media platforms. Now, that was summarized by Governor Brown's people, and then Governor Brown said, as evidenced by the numerous studies by academic and policy groups on the spread of false information, the creation of a statutory advisory group to examine this issue is not necessary. Well, good. I'm glad that he shut it down. It was very pervasive, as New American says in conclusion. He was correct to veto it. It's a shame, however, that he didn't veto it on the principles of the free speech and the First Amendment. Instead of just saying, well, we don't really need this. That's kind of vague. Let's talk a little bit about what this would have done, because I expect we're going to see this again coming from more Democrats. The bill would have required the California Attorney General to create an advisory committee that would consist of at least one person from the Department of Justice, representatives from social media providers, and civil liberties advocates, as well as First Amendment scholars. It would come up with a plan, then, for social media platforms to fix the problem of fake information. This is a fool's errand. Nobody believes that this could be done, but this is a tool for control, just as Senator Richard Pan's other bill was a tool for control, saying you're going to get your vaccination on my schedule. You're going to take the things that I say that you have to take. And I don't really care what you as a patient think. I don't care what you as a parent think. I don't care what your doctor thinks. I'm going to tell you what to do. And you're going to do it on my schedule. And if you don't do it on my schedule, your kid's not going to go to school, get an education. How about that? And getting back to this particular bill, again, showing his authoritarian side, The Electronic Frontier Foundation pushed back against it, and they said established case law prevents the government from positioning itself as the arbiter of which statements are fictional and which are truthful. Indeed, false statements are often constitutionally protected speech. That's what Brown should have said. I'm glad that he did what he did, but we don't have leaders anymore. When these guys do the right thing, they do it and hope that nobody, you know, they try to straddle the fence every time they do anything. Another group, Media Literacy Now. Media Literacy Now, an organization aimed at teaching children how to think critically about messages they encounter in the media. Who would think that we would ever want to have something called critical thinking? That we would ever want to think? We're going to have the government do the thinking for us, right? Anyway, what they said was the intention of this bill is to help control the spread of information deemed as false. But who will make these determinations? Should the government be in the position to determine what is truth and what is fiction? Yes, if we want an Orwellian society. They called it the Ministry of Truth. That's what George Orwell called it. And so this was an effort by Richard Pan, the authoritarian little state senator in California. Mark my word, this guy is going to be elevated to national politics. Anybody that's that authoritarian in the Democrat Party has got a big career ahead of them. But if you're going to have the government determine what is true and what isn't, then the government is, we should rightfully call that the Ministry of Truth bill, Senator Pan. And we should understand what it is essentially going to turn into is government lying to us and propagandizing us, of course. They went on to say, or should an educated citizenry be able to use critical analysis tools acquired through media literacy education to determine this for themselves? This bill treads on a slippery slope toward government censorship, and it might infringe on First Amendment rights. No, it definitely would. It's not a might. There's no might about it. So where is all this stuff going, right? When we look at the Kavanaugh situation, your privilege level, writes the Mises Institute. How much can the left steal from you in the name of equality? They're trying to steal our First Amendment and our free speech and our freedom of the press, saying we have to be, we have to get rid of hate and so forth. Well, there's a lot of things that the left hates. They hate free speech, for one. They hate your ability to defend yourself. As the Mises Institute points out in an article on Zero Hedge, the left has become increasingly, often bizarrely obsessed with all manners of supposed privilege. BuzzFeed even put out a quiz on how much privilege you have. Various privileges work to form a simple Marxist-like dichotomy between the oppressed and the oppressor. And that's precisely what this is, folks. As I've pointed out many times, this is the masterstroke of Bill Ayers. Bill Ayers stopped bombing buildings and killing people with the Weatherman. He got off those terrorists. He wasn't jailed for any of that terrorism. He escaped that, and then he went into education, and his group popularized the idea of white skin privilege. He realized that the old paradigm of class struggle based on economic divisions wasn't working well. So they decided they would create the paradigm of class struggle based on racial division. But it's not just that. As the Mises Institute points out, so for whites, men, heterosexuals, Christians, cisgendered, oh, I hate that term, able-bodied, attractive people are all at least privileged, if not part of the oppressor class. On the other hand, people of color, women, homosexuals, the disabled, Muslims, people of other faiths, transgendered, overweight people, presumably other kins, headmates, whatever other buzzwords the self-diagnosed psychos have come up with, all those people are oppressed. And then they say it's hard to imagine a more effective way to increase division in society than by splitting everyone into different groups that are either good or bad, privileged or oppressed. And this is essentially what this Kavanaugh hearing is about. Let's play CNN's Jeffrey Toobin and go out with this clip.
Suggestion? Maybe the base is much of the United States. Maybe this country is a lot more racist and sexist than we thought. Maybe a lot of people find this allegation preposterous.
Well, Jeffrey,
maybe a lot of people think, who won the election?
Yeah, no,
the
right.
guy from the Access Hollywood tape won the election.
But don't go back to 2016, Jeffrey. I think the president was making that point.
We'll be right back. That maybe people are finding the Democrats a lot more mentally ill than they ever expected. But you have to understand that it is there is a strategy, a diabolical strategy, to divide and conquer.
Making sense common again. It's your host, David Knight.
Welcome back. I'm going to get into MGM 1 year later. Kanye West and Saturday Night Live. Give an update on Elon Musk and NAFTA 2.0. But before we do, I have to say something about Jeff Flake and how he flaked out. As I tweeted out Friday afternoon, I said, as I predicted, I said it when I was talking to Alex. I said, I don't trust Flake. I think this guy is going to flip. And sure enough, he did. Flake flipped out. So I tweeted out. I said, as I predicted, he flipped out. And I said, later generations are really going to think that the term flaked out really came from Jeff Flake. Because if we look at the dictionary, the urban dictionary for this, flake is someone who generally makes plans with you, promises to do things with or for you, but can never seem to follow through. Yes, it is an eponym, isn't it? The man who became an adjective. One person who did not flake out, of course, was Lindsey Graham. And there's a funny meme that is floating around. Picture of Lindsey Graham in front of Super Male Vitality bottles. Here it is right there. It's like, Watch out, commies. I took my super male vitality today. That's it. We'll tell you all about super male vitality. We still got it on sale here. So it's not just Lindsey taking advantage of that. You, too, can stand up to the left just like Lindsey Graham with your super male vitality. But he had this to say. He revealed what he said, what he gave credit to, giving him backbone to stand up to these people. Here's Lindsey Graham telling you what he thinks is the reason that he stood up to them. Not super male vitality, but this.
Himself, South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham sits on the Senate Judiciary, Armed Services, and Budget Committees. Senator, it is good to have you this morning. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
And let me say thank you for your leadership and your courage this past week. What prompted you?
Outrage at a star chamber process. I've known Brett for 20 years. He's gone through six FBI background investigations. He's appointed more women to be his law clerk than any circuit judge in the country. He's highly respected. Not one hint of impropriety. And they tried to destroy his life. I voted for Sotomayor and Kagan. This was about delaying the hearing, keeping the seat open past the midterms so it could be filled in 2020. There are no rules when it comes to Brett Kavanaugh. I honored Obama's election. He got to pick Sotomayor and Kagan. They do not want to honor President Trump's ability to pick a fine man. I was, when Durbin told him, turn to Don McGahn if you're truly innocent, and asked for this to continue, that was a bridge too far. And I think I spoke in a way that a lot of Republicans, at least, could relate to. And I'm a bipartisan guy. I will continue to be. But when it comes to judicial nominees nominated by our side, I'm going to make sure they're treated fairly, and he was not.
And he was not.
And again, to recap what he had to say there, he said, look, Kavanaugh made the case himself. He talked about the many different times that he enumerated them. Six different times he's already been investigated by the FBI. And we've already had the testimony of what he said, what she said. These other people that they're now going to get the testimony of declined to testify under oath. Does that tell us anything about how confident they are about this? You don't want to commit perjury, so you're just going to make those allegations in the New Yorker, and then your lawyer told you to set this out? And then he also pointed out that he voted for these Supreme Court picks that Obama had because Obama won the election. But as far as these people are concerned, Trump winning the election is going to be opposed in every way possible. And that's what we saw from Stephen Colbert. So we're going to shut this thing down. And we don't care whether he's guilty or innocent. We don't care whether she was harmed or not. We're going to shut this thing down. You're not going to get a Supreme Court pick. And so he had one other thing to say, which I think was very true. We'll talk about this later. I want to get into these other issues before we do. But Graham also had this to say. He said, what needs to happen is we need to have an investigation of Dianne Feinstein, not a seventh investigation of Brett Kavanaugh.
One of the questions, though, is it appears that the FBI will not be questioning those college witnesses who contradict Brett Kavanaugh's testimony about his drinking. Now, isn't that relevant, given that there clearly was drinking going on, at least it's alleged at the party?
No, I think you're trying to portray him as a stumbling, bumbling, drunk gang rapist who during high school and college was Bill Cosby, 6 FBI background checks over the years would have uncovered this. What we will investigate is who in Dianne Feinstein's office referred Dr. Ford to Ms. Katz. That's illegal, inappropriate in the Senate. So the FBI will do a supplemental background investigation. Then I'm going to call for an investigation of what happened in this committee, who betrayed Dr. Ford's trust, who in Feinstein's office recommended Katz as a lawyer. Why did Ms. Ford not know that the committee was willing to go to California? Who released the anonymous letter given to the committee by Cory Gardner? We're going to do a wholesale, full-scale investigation of what I think was a despicable process to deter it from happening again.
And of course, that was one of the first things that Lindsey Graham said. He said to Kavanaugh, he said, were you aware that 20 some odd days before you came before the committee, that Dianne Feinstein had already contacted the witness and was setting her up with a lawyer. In other words, they were holding all this. They were delaying all of this. And, of course, the purpose of all this is to try to run the clock out. And that's where Jeff Flake comes in. Jeff Flake, who is not going to be running for re-election, he's trying to figure out, I think, how he is going to position himself on K Street as a lobbyist after this election. And maybe he has decided that he doesn't want to annoy the GOP too much because he's going to have to lobby them in the future. So he doesn't want to completely burn down his bridges. So he has to come up with some kind of a pretense for which he can sit on the fence and say, well, all right, I'll vote for him to get him out of the committee, but I'm not going to vote for him to be confirmed unless you delay this for another week, because delay is everything, isn't it? And so Ed Rollins, who used to be a political consultant for Ronald Reagan and many other people, came out and said, you know, he is one of the great turncoats. He will go down as one of the great turncoats and cowards in Senate history. And I think everybody, as I said before, will believe that the term flake actually comes from this guy. After screwing the GOP, says PJ Media, this is the headline at PJ Media, after screwing the GOP, Jeff Flake parties with Senator Coons and with rock stars at the Global Citizen Festival. See, Jeff Flake would love nothing more than to burn down the Trump administration, everything that President Trump does. He's made that very clear. But as I said before, he can't be what he's doing right now in terms of coming against Brett Kavanaugh. Brett Kavanaugh is a guy with deep, deep roots into the GOP establishment, not just with President Trump. I mean, if President Trump had gone with an outsider like Amy Barrett, then he would have just vetoed it to start with, I'm sure. But this is a guy who has connections into the GOP establishment, to people like Bush, to people like Lindsey Graham and so forth. So he has to pretend to be somewhat fair-minded. But then right after all of this, you know, he claims that he changed his mind because he was trolled in an elevator by some Soros people. We'll get into that later as well. As well as the fact that this doxing of Republicans may have a connection to Maxine Waters. There's an IP address. It looks like it's one of her staffers. So in not just investigating Feinstein, maybe they should investigate Maxine Waters' staff as well. But he goes to the Global Citizens Rock Festival the next day. And then we had Senator Chris Murphy has admitted that no FBI investigation will change his mind on Kavanaugh. He says, whatever they find doesn't change the fact that Kavanaugh, especially after his performance yesterday, is the most dangerous Supreme Court pick in our lifetime. Is he really dangerous? Or is it Senator Chris Murphy who is dangerous? Remember, Chris Murphy is the one who tweeted out, InfoWars is the tip of a giant iceberg of hate and lies at user sites like Facebook and YouTube. Tear our nation apart. These companies must do more than take down one website. The survival of our democracy depends on it. Yeah, so we're going to take down more than one website. This is a U.S. senator who says that Brett Kavanaugh is dangerous to our form of government. No, it's people like that senator that are dangerous. Welcome back. We're going to take a look at MGM shooting 1 year after. Also going to take a look at Kanye West and Saturday Night Live over the weekend and at NAFTA 2 in just a second. But before we do, real quickly, I want to tell you about some of the specials we have at InfoWarsStore.com, because that's what funds this program. And we have a special, an exclusive discount for the listeners of this program. You can use the code REALNEWS to save 15% off of our large ProPure Gravity Feed water filtration system. That's the ProPure King water filtration system. Save 15% with the coupon code REALNEWS at checkout. You should always be proactive on making sure that your water is clean. And this is the best way that you can do it. And, of course, being gravity feed, it is not dependent on power. So it works well in case you have an emergency, like we have seen with hurricanes and so forth. So any kind of natural or man-made disaster, as well as some unexpected leak into the groundwater or into the city supply of water, if you're on city water. We've seen all of these things happen in the last year or so. And if you go down and look at the list of the chemicals and contaminants that are taken out with ProPure, every time I see one of these articles about something that is leached into the water that people haven't found out about for years or until the symptoms started manifesting themselves in terms of cancer clusters or IQ damage to children, like in Flint, Michigan, the lead in the water system. Every time I go back and look at some of these things, if it's a chemical spill in the groundwater, I look at that chemical, and yeah, it gets out 99.9% of that. So take a look at the ProPure King water filtration system. Again, you can save 15% with the code REALNEWS at InfoWarsStore.com. A couple of other things, of course, Lindsey Graham can re-up on Super Male Vitality, or you can get Super Female Vitality, depending on which way you go. 50% off at InfoWarsStore.com. And if you want to try to understand what all of this stuff is that's happening, if you're having trouble wrapping your head around this stuff, get some Brain Force Plus. It'll help you to focus and to concentrate. You can get that now 40% off. Secret 12, our vitamin B12 formula, 40% off as well. Take a look at the specials that we have at InfoWarsStore.com. We really do appreciate and need your support. All right, we're 1 year after the shooting at MGM, as Wall Street Journal headline says. 1 year later, experts are digging deeper to try to find the Vegas shooter's motive. So we've had no real investigation because we've had no transparency. We've had no truth coming out of the Las Vegas Police Department. Instead, what they've done is do things like examine the shooter's brain physically, not examine the videotapes. Not going to release all those videotapes. A few of them have been released. A few body cams have been released well after the event. They revealed some troubling contradictions, perhaps inadvertently, as they released some of that stuff. But we've seen one contradiction after the other, one story changing after the other. They've had criminal psychologists and threat assessment experts, says the Wall Street Journal, still puzzling over why a wealthy 64-year-old gambler committed the deadliest mass shooting in U.S. history. Experts are used to finding answers as to why mass shooters commit their crimes, whether they're angry at coworkers or fellow students or over perceived slights, or is it terrorism or mental illness. Several hypotheses on the Vegas gunman's possible psychopathy and desire for infamy have begun to emerge, but nothing really. As one person, a psychologist and a partner in a threat assessment firm, said, "We wish we knew more about it. With all the missing data, what everybody says is it's just speculation." That's right. If we can't have a real investigation, and if the government is going to hide this up, and why are they hiding it? Well, of course, they are hiding it to protect MGM. But everybody's going to pretend that they are sympathetic to the victims. They're going to turn the lights out tonight about the time that the firing on the crowd began, even though they've done 10 months of non-investigation. Even though the Las Vegas Police Department has been caught lying one time after the other, changing the narrative to cover for MGM Grand, they are going to pretend to honor the memories of the victims, even though they won't do an investigation, by turning out the lights. I think that is an appropriate footnote to this investigation, because it has been conducted in a way to keep the public in the dark for a year. So why not celebrate it by turning out the lights? That is what they always do in these investigations. I'm not advancing any idea as to what I think happened, but I'm saying that what they're telling us, just like we saw with 9/11, the conspiracy theory that they've come up with, and of course they're saying this is a lone shooter, of course, but just like the conspiracy theory that they produced for 9/11, it's not possible. It doesn't make any sense. There's no motives. There's no reason. There's no explanation for any of this stuff. Just cover-ups and lies. And so what nobody is talking about today, as they talk about how they interview the victims, they talk about the shooting and so forth, what they're not talking about is what came out the middle of July. And that is MGM filing lawsuits against over 1,000 victims and their families. This is the shameful aspect of this. And this is one of the key things at the heart of why the Las Vegas Police Department has been lying and keeping people in the dark for a year and changing the timeline and so forth and bringing out Ellen DeGeneres in that shameful display with Jesus Campos, who disappeared for 4 or 5 days and then reappears on Ellen DeGeneres. No questions to be asked of him as to what happened, because it was necessary for them to change the second narrative that was a contradiction of the first one, completely change it so they could protect MGM from liability. And then the middle of July, MGM, the company that owns Mandalay Bay and the casino there in Las Vegas, asked federal courts to declare that it is not liable in the shooting that happened a year ago today. Many of the victims had filed lawsuits in state courts, and so what they wanted to do was to move it to a federal court where they would have a lot more clout, presumably, or they would be able to use the this is terrorism claim. And that's very key because no finding or determination has been made. They want to go to court and claim that it was terrorism. And so MGM, back in July, and several of its associated companies, Mandalay Bay and several of its companies, filed lawsuits against the victims. They asked federal judges to step in and declare the resort company free from liability. Well, why not? We declared all the vaccine companies free from liability when they demanded it from Washington. We declared all the telecommunication companies, that was the 1986 Act, they gave them legal liability protection, immunity for the vaccine companies from damaging or killing people. And then we did the same thing 10 years later. Anytime for telecommunications companies with antenna clusters can't look at the health effects of antenna clusters, and that is a very big story now that they're going to be putting antennas every 50 feet with 5G. Of course, it'll be lower power, but you're going to be closer to them as well. And they are different in terms of the quality of radiation that comes out of them. Qualitatively different as well. So when it comes to the interest of big corporations, just as we've seen with the self-driving cars, they want to roll all this stuff into the federal government. We've seen it with GMOs and everything. So MGM, let's put this into the federal courts. And then to do that, to preemptively do that, they filed a federal lawsuit, MGM, against more than 800 defendants in California and more than 200 in Nevada. The defendants were victims of the shooting who had threatened lawsuits against MGM Resorts or had actually filed lawsuits. And so MGM's federal lawsuit cites a 2002 federal law designed to encourage companies to deploy anti-terrorism security technologies without fear of being held responsible for damages if a terror attack happens anyway. So they're saying, hey, we put in this video camera footage here, which we're not going to show anybody, but that could make us liable. And so you told us to put the video camera footage in there to help protect against terror events, but since we didn't do anything with it, we're going to say that that doesn't make us liable. Isn't that interesting how that works out? And so at the time, Forbes was asking, will they tarnish their brand? Evidently not, because the mainstream media won't talk about how MGM is now attacking the survivors and the families of survivors after this. On this one-year event, to me, that is the thing that sticks out the most, how they are covering up for the big corporation. All we're doing, they said, is in effect, we're asking for a change in venue from state to federal court. We're not asking for money or attorney's fees. We're just trying to keep them from getting any of our money. We only want to resolve these cases quickly, fairly, efficiently, and to hide all the evidence so we could get to the bottom of what really happened. Was this a weapons deal that went south? Was this some kind of a false flag event? You know, there's some very suspicious stuff that happened with flights in and out of there. And Telehub looked at that, said, is there some exfil going on here with helicopters? A lot of suspicious activity with that. So we don't want to get to a resolution in terms of finding out what really happened here. We don't want anybody to get compensation from MGM. And, of course, they didn't put those cameras in there to protect against terrorism. Casinos have been leading the world in terms of surveillance cameras forever. I mean, you look at the Departments of Transportation and the cameras that they have on the highways. Those are cameras that were originally designed for the casinos. We'll be right back. Stay with us.
Making Sense Common Again. It's your host, David Knight.
Welcome back. We had some interesting developments. Came out on Friday that Elon Musk was being sued by the SEC. But as Zero Hedge points out, if anybody had any doubt that the SEC would put its regulatory interests ahead of holding a high-profile CEO accountable for a brazen violation of security laws, rest assured, the agency's $40 million fine against Tesla's CEO Elon Musk was little more than a slap on the wrist. Yeah, it was $20 million for the company, $20 million for him. And how much did it cost the investors who were shorting that failing company when he put that out to boost the stock market price. They are the ones who are now going to be suing Elon Musk because the government is not going to do anything of any substance with this. Of course not. He is the king of crony capitalism. He is a key person in this effort by the U.S. government to make sure that you are going to drive an electric car and you're going to lose control of all private cars eventually. But you're going to have an electric car first. If you want to get a non-electric car, you can get a non-electric car. But as Obama said, it'll bankrupt you, just as they wanted to bankrupt any coal plants. No matter how clean they were, they want to bankrupt any internal combustion engine, whether it's diesel or gasoline. They want to bankrupt you if you want to try to buy something that's going to last for a while. If you want to buy a private car, they're going to bankrupt you with the insurance companies, with the regulations, with the extra safety features on there. While they let these people with the self-driving cars and electric vehicles, they subsidize electric vehicles, and they give the people who have the self-driving cars a pass on every kind of safety inspection. I mean, when you look at the history of Uncle Fed and how everything has to be so incredibly safe, even people in the past, it's just been Eric Peters, who's talked about this. But now we've got even the establishment press, like Car and Driver, saying, how come electric, self-driving cars are getting a regulatory pass when we can't even upgrade to LED headlights because of the safety concerns of the Department of Transportation, Federal Department of Transportation? But when we look at this, so we have Tesla shares soaring 14% after this settlement. And it's kind of interesting because he didn't tweet anything today. He's now had his hands slapped over Twitter. But now it appears that Elon Musk is still allowed to manipulate the marketplace with emails that get sent out. And as Zero Hedge points out, unwilling to give the bears even a day to reassess, Musk had already set out over the weekend to repair the damage wrought by this most bizarre of corporate scandals. With his Twitter use now constrained by terms of the settlement, Musk instead likely leaked two unambiguously bullish emails to CNBC in which he exhorted Tesla staff to go all out on Sunday, the very last day of the quarter, to achieve an important production benchmark on the Tesla Model 3. In the emails, he claimed that the company is very close to finally turning a profit after years of burning massive amount of cash. But of course, that's okay when the government is there to cover for you. You're going to push the government's environmental control agenda? Oh, here's a big wad of money for you. Since Musk must now pre-clear any tweets with potentially market-moving implications, it appears that leaking bullish emails has now become his new strategy of choice for punching people who want a short sell in the nose. So Tesla shares are up 14% in pre-market trading today. As Elon Musk would say, epic. Epic. Now, he has to step down as chairman, but he will remain as CEO. And as CEO, he's got a lot of lawsuits that he'll be facing, as I said, not just the lawsuits from investors, but of course, he's got multiple lawsuits from investors, from employees. He has lawsuits involving the sale of lemons, because pushing these things out the door, they have 85% of them have to be reworked. They're playing a lot of games in terms of the number of vehicles that they got finished. And that's part of the fraud that is being conducted against shareholders. I don't own their shares, but I have to pay for it with my taxes. I have to subsidize people who are spending six figures for a car.
It's the real news. Live from the Infowars.com studios in Austin, Texas, it's your host, David Knight.
Welcome back. Let's take a look at what happened on Saturday Night Live this weekend. And as President Trump said, he was accurate to say it, this has become nothing but a paid political announcement for the Democrat Party. He said, like many, I don't watch Saturday Night Live, even though in the past I hosted it. It's no longer funny. There's no talent. There's no charm. It is just a political ad for the Democrats. Word is that Kanye West, who put on a MAGA hat after the show, despite being told not to, was great. He's leading the charge, said President Trump. So let's take a look at what actually happened with Kanye West. He had his feed cut. They said they were running overtime, so they cut his feed. We'll see what happened with this. Let's play a little bit of a clip as Fox News analysts look at this. Here's video clip number two.
It's amazing. I'll tell you, as a minority conservative woman, I understand the kind of abuse that he's gotten. And, you know, he's somebody who has the power and the cultural creds to get up there and take it. And I think in a lot of ways he sees himself as, you know, sharing dragon energy with Donald Trump because yeah. He says what he thinks. And this is what America's about.
Well, what's so significant is that he really doesn't stand to gain anything. I mean, standing for his conviction, risk everything and being ostracized in that Hollywood, in that music crowd, is almost a certain thing. So to do that, it's really no greater indication of deeply held conviction.
This is after the show was over, by the way. They cut the credits early. I mean, they always do, so they weren't necessarily cutting him off. But he says he was bullied backstage, and ultimately there were like three people clapping. If you watch this clip, the room was silent. Now, America is clapping with him, and I think he understands that. This idea of I'm going to put my Superman cape on, this idea that I put this hat on, and it brings people out of the woodwork and their hatred, and it reveals...
All right, so let's hold it there. You know, this is the type of thing we're seeing where we have Roseanne Barr, who has the most popular show, not nearly as overtly political as Murphy Brown, but she has a popular show, and because she supports President Trump, she is run out of town. You'll never work in this industry again, is basically the way that they're putting this. And we had the same thing happen with other programs. Last Man Standing is now back, and we'll see how long that lasts before they come after him. But Murphy Brown, they want Murphy Brown, and the viewers don't want to see Murphy Brown. Has horrible ratings, but they're not going to cancel Murphy Brown. They will do everything to make that work. And so you got Kanye West on Saturday Night Live having the courage to stand up to these people. I can applaud him for that. I mean, when you have the courage of your convictions in this crowd that demands groupthink, that will not tolerate any dissent from their political opinions and will ruthlessly punish anybody that they disagree with. That's a lot of courage to stand up and do that. So following his performance of Ghost Town, a song that he had or a rap that he had, Kanye West put on his cap in support of Trump and went into a rant. And they cut the feed. As they said, they were out of time. But Chris Rock streamed some of it on his Instagram account. He was in the audience. And, of course, Chris Rock was with the establishment Hollywood crowd. He is going to laugh and jeer along with them. But one of the things, some of the stuff that Kanye West said was, I want to cry right now. Black man in America supposed to keep what you're feeling inside right now. He said the blacks want always Democrats. You know, it's like the plan they did to take the fathers out of the home and put them on welfare. Does anybody know about that? That's a Democratic plan. There's so many times I talk to like a white person about this and they say, how could you like Trump? He's racist. Well, if I was concerned about racism, I would have moved out of America a long time ago. And so other things that he had to say. But, you know, when we talk about taking the fathers out of the home, putting everybody on welfare, this is coming for everybody, folks. The stuff that he said about the 13th Amendment and saying that it made people feel like they were okay because it was a formal declaration to the end of slavery. But people don't know that they're already slaves. And there's a lot of white people who don't know that they're slaves. And that is essentially what he's having to say. He clarified what he meant by saying that about the 13th Amendment. When we look at what he had to say about taking the fathers out of the home and putting them on welfare, we've had economists like Charles Murray back in the 1980s. He wrote the book Losing Ground, and he proved it. He said, look at this. The welfare system that we said was there to help poor people, a lot of them inner city blacks, he says this has actually harmed them. It has destroyed the family. And so that was the basis for welfare reform. But now people like Charles Murray, the same guy who wrote that, many libertarians, many conservatives are now joining with the Democrats in a plan to do this to everybody. This kind of plan will be universal. They even call it universal basic income. It is universal basic dependence. Because they know that the changes coming in technology are going to concentrate wealth far more than you have ever seen in the past. Far more. They want to talk about the wealthiest 1% of the 1% of the 1% getting so wealthy, people like Jeff Bezos. That's nothing compared to what's coming. We're going to be seeing, perhaps, Great Depression levels of unemployment. And how are they going to keep you down on the farm instead of going to Washington with pitchforks and torches? They're going to try to bribe you away, make you passive with welfare. And this is coming for all of us. It's going to be universal. We better come to grips with what they did to black people in the inner city with the welfare program. Because if we don't, all of our heads are on the chopping block. Because they've got a plan for everybody that is coming very soon. Everybody who thinks that they are free. You don't understand where this is really going. Kanye West was laughed at. He was booed by the audience. Of course, because it's the Saturday Night Live audience. They cut the feed. They went to credits before he got into that. And as they tweeted out, wow, only three people clapped. Chris Rock is laughing at Kanye West. He said, they bully me. They bully me backstage and said, don't go out there with that hat on. He says, okay. Then he put on the familiar red hat on his head and he said, or I'm going to put my Superman cape on. That means you can't tell me what to do. And so that's what he said. That's my Superman cape, putting on the red hat. He said, 90% of news, LA media, writers, New York, rappers, musicians are liberal. So it's easy to make it seem like they're so one-sided. And then one of the other things he had to say was, we will no longer outsource to other countries. We will build factories here in America, and we will create jobs, said Kanye West. He said, this represents good and America becoming whole again. We will no longer outsource to other countries. We will build factories here in America and create jobs. We will provide jobs for all those who are free from prisons as we abolish the 13th Amendment. And he had to explain. He said, the 13th Amendment followed up. People that abolish the 13th Amendment that formally said that black slavery, chattel slavery, was illegal. Why would you want to abolish that? Well, he said the 13th Amendment is slavery in disguise, meaning that it never ended. In other words, it was a head fake. And I agree, we need to understand where this slavery is coming from now. And he was right to point to the welfare state. And there's slavery coming for us all, universally white and black, if we don't understand this. He talks about jobs, yeah, jobs that we're going to lose, not just because they've exported them to foreign countries and brought in foreign labor, but because they've been given the ability to repatriate their capital offshore and build robot factories here, where it will be mechanized, going to be immigrant laborers. So we'll have everybody that's been brought in here with the open borders will be fighting everybody else. This is a divide and conquer strategy. They will try to buy us off with that slavery. And so again, President Trump also cited the historic low African-American unemployment in America. He said, how do Democrats who have done nothing for African-Americans but talk, how do they win the black vote? Well, they'd win it by banning everybody who says anything that disagrees with them and by shutting off not only a free press on social media, but by coming after social media, they shut off the free speech of the citizens. Folks, it's not just Kanye West that they're concerned about. It's not just InfoWars that they're concerned about. It's not just conservative press or radio talk show hosts that they're concerned about. They're concerned about you hearing something, seeing something, thinking about it, agreeing with it, or disagreeing with it and passing that on. They don't want your free speech. That's what they're really afraid of. They have to pacify your free speech just like they have to pacify you once they take your job away in about 10 years. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Back. I'm David Knight. We're going to be joined in the next segment with Matt Bracken. Matt's going to come in and talk a little bit about what's going on with Kavanaugh, the deeper story behind this, the backstory behind this. So be sure to stick around for Matt Bracken joining us in the next segment. Before we do, and before we get to the NAFTA 2.0 information, I want to tell you a little bit about the specials that we have at InfoWarsStore.com because that's what funds this program. We have a special for listeners of this program. 15% off the ProPure King water filtration system. That's the large gravity feed filter from ProPure. Just use the coupon code REALNEWS at checkout to save 15% off the ProPure King water filtration system. We also have our final run of Survival Shield X2 Nascent Iodine. You can now get that at 25% off while supplies last. We have Brain Force Plus, 40% off. Secret 12, our vitamin B12 formula, 40% off. And we have both Super Male and Super Female Vitality, both of those 50% off. Take a look at the specials we have at InfoWarsStore.com. We really do appreciate your support. We're just talking about the focus on jobs, and we're going to get in now into NAFTA 2.0. And as I was saying, Kanye West was rightfully saying the Democrat welfare system has damaged the black family. And it has. We all understand that. And as I was pointing out, we have massive unemployment coming with automation. I find it interesting that the people at Whole Foods staff are worried that Amazon wants us to be robots. They don't realize, I think, just how literally that is going to be the case. It'll be robots replacing a lot of people in a lot of different industries. As many studies have shown, it's going to be every industry. So it's going to be horizontal across all industries all at once. It's not just going to be something where you see the agriculture, the farms automated, and then people can leave the farm and you can still have the food grown with fewer people, and all the people then go into the city or they go into manufacturing. So, no, it's not going to be that way. It's going to be the farms, it's going to be manufacturing, it's going to be retail, it's going to be things like doctors and lawyers losing their jobs. Studies in South Korea, as I've quoted before, said that by 2030, 70% of the tasks that were being done by doctors would be replaced by artificial intelligence and robots. It would be about 50 to 60% for lawyers and judges. Of 398 jobs that they looked at, about 85% of the jobs could be done by robots. Some of the jobs will be 100% done by robots. So it's going to result in a lot of displacement and work. It's not just going to affect people at the bottom right now, not just the people who are working in the warehouses or working as blue collar and manufacturing. It's going to affect everybody. And so the people at Whole Foods are saying, well, Amazon's taking this over. They want to turn us all into robots. So that is quite literal. And how are we going to deal with that? How are we going to deal with that? That's really the situation of the future. Now they're trying to deal with what's happening right now. They're trying to organize into unions to fight them or whatever. That's not going to work. But we can take a look at what's going on with trade. Yes, we need to do something about trade, but we also need to take the longer view on trade as well. Because the problem with NAFTA isn't simply that it was a bad deal. Yeah, it was a bad deal, but it was also an erasure of American sovereignty, subsuming us into this multilateral agreement. And so whether or not this is a good thing, and it is temporarily definitely a good thing, definitely a good thing. But let's take a look at the bigger picture here. As Bloomberg points out, U.S. and Canada reach a trade deal to keep NAFTA trilateral. They've done this at the very last minute last night. To keep NAFTA trilateral. You hear that? And they emphasize this in Bloomberg. The U.S. and Canada have agreed on a trade deal that would save the North American Free Trade Agreement as a trilateral bloc. U.S. and Canadian negotiators have been negotiating around the clock this weekend to make a Sunday night midnight deadline that would allow the countries to retain the 24-year-old trilateral agreement. U.S. lawmakers and businesses have urged the administration to keep Canada in the deal, but the trilateral nature has been in jeopardy after Trump on August 27th announced that he had reached a deal with Mexico, and Canada could join if it was willing to make concessions. So, as I said at the time, I said, that's great. He's talking about bilateral agreements. He's made a bilateral agreement with Mexico. He told Justin Trudeau, well, you can get in if you want, but I've already got a deal with them. You want to make a deal? You can make a deal with the two of us or whatever. I said, it's good. Put pressure on him. It's triangulating for a better deal. But is it simply just triangulating, or is it about preserving the trilateral nature of NAFTA? That is the real question for the long term. Yes, short term, we have good news in terms of trade. But are we sacrificing our long-term sovereignty? Are we committing suicide in the long term for the short-term expediency? We always do that when we do these budget deficits, don't we? We always just kick the can down the road, and it is accelerating rapidly. The two nations said the deal would be called the United States-Mexico-Canada Agreement. So instead of NAFTA, we've got USMCA. President Trump tweeted out, it's a wonderful new deal. Canada had agreed to provide U.S. dairy farmers access to about 3.5% of its approximately $16 billion annual domestic dairy market, said sources, adding that the Canadian government was prepared to offer compensation to dairy farmers who were hurt by the deal. The quota would allow for significant growth in tariff-free automotive exports from Canada above current production levels of about 2 million units. That would safeguard Canadian plants. So do you understand what's happening here? They're going to get an increase in Canadian cars that can come across the border. They're going to allow more American dairy products to be sold there. As it hurts the Canadian dairy farmers, the Canadian government is going to subsidize them. And so the president elect of the NAFTA, of President elect Obrador's NAFTA negotiator, said, "We celebrate the trilateral agreement." There's that word again. "The door is closed to the fragmentation of the region." And then he goes on to say, "NAFTA 2 will give certainty and stability to Mexican trade with its partners in North America." They have closed the door in terms of fragmenting the region. They have consolidated the trilateral agreement. And the Mexican negotiator says this is NAFTA 2.0. And that's my concern with it. As we see the desperation of Justin Trudeau, the desperation wasn't simply to have a good trade deal, because as we showed, he was willing to throw the dairy farmers there in Canada under the bus. He's willing to do anything to preserve the trilateral union, because these unions always begin, as we see with the European Union, they always begin with an economic trade bloc. They can't see that coming apart. And so I'm very concerned that what we have exchanged is a short-term economic gain for a long-term loss of sovereignty. This was a golden opportunity to get rid of NAFTA, and we have lost that. Nevertheless, it's being presented by Bloomberg and others as a crucial win for Trump, because they want to keep this globalist agenda going. At the same time, to keep this in perspective, this weekend, we had France's leaders, their French foreign affairs minister, said that they were going to have a new alliance of goodwill powers, said that they could not allow powerful democracies that share a commitment to multilateralism to fall by the wayside. Again, a pushback against the nationalism that President Trump has pushed on, a pushback against bilateralism. They're saying we want to have multilateralism and international structures in place.
Making sense common again. It's your host, David Knight.
Welcome back. Joining us now is Matt Bracken, a former Navy SEAL, self-described freedomista, a constitutionalist who believes in original intent. Hey, maybe we ought to put this guy on the Supreme Court. I'd like to see a constitutionalist who believes in original intent put on. Maybe not necessarily the guy we got there. But I want to talk to Matt about the dirty tricks that are being played, the polarization that is being done, the fact that we've seen that the Democrats will burn this country down, every relationship, dividing everybody into one group or the other and pitting all the different groups against each other, the tactics that we're seeing here displayed, shameful tactics. Of course, you can find Matt on enemiesforeignanddomestic.com. That's his website. Also on Twitter, Matt Bracken 48. And of course, you spell his last name Bracken, Matt Bracken 48. You know, Matt, thank you for joining us. We've now got the FBI investigation that they were salivating over. And one of the people that they're going to talk to, and as we're talking about this, I've played and I'll play again later today, Biden saying back 27 years ago, 1991, when they had the Clarence Thomas hearings, he said, "I don't want to hear any more about the FBI investigating people. Anybody that says that doesn't know what they're talking about. The FBI will take depositions from these people. They'll say, he said this, she said that, and they're not going to draw any conclusions." Well, we had 8 or 9 hours worth of testimony from the two of them. And it's basically just a repeat of this. And so now they're going to have the FBI, because of what Jeff Flake did, they're going to have the FBI talk to Ramirez. This is the lady who needed 6 days with a Democrat lawyer to be able to remember what had happened 35 years ago. But then that same lawyer wrote a letter and said she's not going to be testifying. He didn't want her to go under oath to talk about her recall of these events. What do you make of all this?
Yeah, false memory syndrome is a big element of what we're seeing, I think. And when you combine the way that memory is much more malleable than it used to be thought. And when you combine that with an underlying predisposition or wish to see a political outcome, people will start remembering, what's convenient. In the case of Christine Blasey Ford, she didn't start remembering this incident until 2012, around the time that Mitt Romney was, possibly going to be the next president, and Kavanaugh's name was being floated. So she had known Kavanaugh from childhood, so the name was deep in her memory. Kavanaugh's mother had sat on a foreclosure hearing. Not that it came out, it wasn't that they were enemies, but I'm sure that with her daughter aware of the foreclosure proceedings, the name Kavanaugh in 1996 would have popped into her consciousness again. Mm-hmm. And then when Mitt Romney is looking like he might be president, here comes that name Kavanaugh again. And only after that did she start forming this memory into a strategy. And it's very important to think about some things. I've read that up to 70% of the cases that are overturned on DNA, which is scientific evidence, the original convictions were based on eyewitness testimony. So eyewitness testimony today is considered very fallible. And in fact, what often happens is very eager and gung-ho prosecutors virtually coach witnesses into a false memory by having them repeat over and over again what they're going to say on the stand under cross-examination. They practice moot court cross-examination, and this is how you'll get Christine Blasey Ford to come out and say, "How sure were you? 100% sure." You can bet that her attorneys practiced that with her constantly for the more than a week before during her preparation.
You can play games with people's minds.
And the Ramirez woman from Yale, now she's going to, up before it was fairly free for her to make these charges, but now she's going to have to really commit to it, in sworn testimony. It'll be interesting to see how far she's willing to stick her neck out. The left
her
now
lawyer
is trying
had
to
said basically she's not going to come in and testify. She had the opportunity to do it last week. She's not going to come in and testify. Read the New Yorker. And of course, the key thing about all this stuff and the key reason why Jeff Flake is doing this is because this is all about stalling and trying to run the clock out.
Right. And not only stalling, but pivoting to new strategies. Now he's an angry drunk with a bad temperament.
Yeah.
I saw a cartoon this morning. It's so vile. It's unbelievable, where Kavanaugh's daughter is praying at the bed and says, and Lord, please pray for my father, the angry drunk who sexually assaulted that lady.
Wow. Turns it all upside down from what he had to say.
Yeah.
His daughter was praying for the false accuser. And
right.
Now they have pray for my father, the angry drunk. I saw a cartoon with a male's hands around the throat of Lady Liberty. Okay, dropped the torch and so forth, and on the sleeves was embroidered the GOP logo. So it's like, this is Brett Kavanaugh choking, and the Republicans choking Liberty, Lady Liberty, to death.
Well, pulling out, zooming back a little bit for more of a macro picture, we saw with Hillary, the Democrats made a bet that they could switch from appealing to the angry white deplorables to just the, minorities, gays, lesbians, everybody angry at the establishment, and make that a winning strategy. And in 2016, it came up short. Trump was elected. But instead of recalculating this strategy, they're virtually doubling down. And we saw it on the Judiciary Committee. Kavanaugh is being crucified as a stand-in for you and me.
That's right.
It could be you or me, or a young man in college when they go before these star chamber sex trials where you're not allowed to testify. It's basically the female accuser comes in and you're guilty.
That's
so
right.
this
This is a strategy and tactics of Bill Ayer and the Weather Underground, because they realized, as I said earlier in the broadcast, they weren't getting anywhere with their old Marxist paradigm of just breaking people into economic classes. So they would decided that they would break us into every kind of class that they could. And so you and I are the privileged. And, you know, because we're white males, and this is the kind of hatred that they're doing, you know, male against female, white against black, everybody against everybody, every kind of identity politics they can do. And it is to set up this divide and conquer strategy.
Yeah. And as far as I'm concerned, if they're willing to do full out scorched earth character assassination, including putting out a casting call for liars, which is why they held, one of the reasons they held Christine Blasey Ford out for 10 days was a universal casting call for anybody else, you know, Avenetti's claimant, Ms. Swetlik, or Ramirez, anybody that wants to come forward, this is your chance, casting call. But if the left loses this, if he's confirmed, and if the Republican base is energized and they retain control of Congress, what we're going to see after November 3rd, I believe, is a civil war, because I think that the Democrats only work within the political system, gaming it. They mouth obedience to the Constitution while trampling all over it, as we saw with their, you know, no more presumption of innocence. You're just guilty because you're an angry white man.
Oh, yeah.
What we're going to see is just saying, forget it. If we can't control the Supreme Court, which is the left's Politburo, it was never intended to be a super legislature, but that's what it's become in the last, you know, 30, 40 years, at least since Roe v. Wade, a super legislature. And when, as long as Anthony Kennedy was the 4.5 vote, you know, the pivot vote in the middle, they could live with it grudgingly. They can't live with Kavanaugh. And if they don't take control of Congress, meaning that the committees, which is where the real power in Congress is currently, especially with weaklings like Ryan and McConnell, if the Intelligence Committee stays in the hands of, you know, Devin Nunes, doesn't flip to Adam Schiff, if you know, Feinstein doesn't become head of judiciary, they're going to freak out and just say, that's it. We're done working inside the political system. We're going to see James Hodgkinson type attacks where they're just going to say, we're finished working inside. It didn't work. We're not getting our way.
We're going to take a break. We're going to be right back with Matt Bracken. We're going to talk about what we can do to make sure that the Supreme Court doesn't become the ultimate legislature. And what kind of jeopardy do these people who are making these false allegations have? That may be one of the checks that's coming up. We'll be right back with Matt Bracken. Welcome back. I'm David. I'm talking to Matt Bracken. Matt, you know, I look at this, and one of the things that stuck out to me about this Kavanaugh hearing was the spinelessness of the GOP. They were afraid to question Ford directly. They were also afraid, even though we have seen excerpts from her yearbook, and we published them here at Infowars.com. We had the article showing some of the pages where they were talking about the wild alcohol, the underage drinking, the wild parties that were being held with her people, with her and with her school and so forth. We were not allowed to see that. The GOP staffers had told people they were afraid to release that as part of the hearing. And yet we saw everything about Brett Kavanaugh. And now he is a legendary drunk, according to the Democrats. So the GOP is afraid to directly question her. They're afraid to show her yearbook, because if we look at both of those yearbooks, what we see there is a disturbing pattern of morality, or I would say lack of it, with the children of these D.C. elite. Because when we look at this Georgetown prep school, it's only a 38-minute drive from there to the Supreme Court. And so these are people who grew up in this Washington area, and it's in that area where you've got kids not only engaging in this kind of behavior, but putting it on the yearbook. That was one of my questions when I looked at this. I said, is this for real? Could this be really put in a yearbook where you have adult supervisors in a high school and where you've got parents taking out ads in the yearbook? Could this really be for real? And apparently it is in both of these different schools, because they went to different schools. This is a symptom of the moral decay, I think, throughout the Washington, D.C. area, of everything that's there. But I think it's also the spinelessness of the GOP. What do you think?
Yeah, total spinelessness. We saw that with Jeff Flake getting rolled.
Yeah.
But there's a competing strand, which was Lindsey Graham. Lindsey Graham decided not to give her his time over to the, you know, the very feckless deposition taker, in the, you know, that the Lady Mitchell. But Flake is clearly auditioning for his next gig, which is going to be on MSNBC or CNN. He'll be like, you know, the good Republican. That's he's auditioning for that gig. He can't be. He knew he'd be voted out as senator. But what I see in these people that have come out against Kavanaugh, the Caucasians of them, there's a saying, I believe it's by Susan Sontag from way back in the day, but she's like a founding light of the social justice movement, is that treason to whiteness is loyalty to humanity. So if you want to be an ally, you know, if you want to not be a deplorable, if you want to prove that you're an ally, you have to come over and really be a traitor to your own people, which would include like that an entire elite, you know, Maryland suburbs culture that she came out of. So,
well, that's the only way people like Chris Murphy and these other people can survive is it's kind of like, you know, a gang, right? You got to prove your creds. And so you got to go out and assassinate somebody, maybe somebody close to you. So they come out and they're the worst ones because they're the ones who go the most viciously after white people because they got to protect themselves because they're white, right? So they got to show that they're loyal to the non-white.
A Ward Churchill actually faking that he was an Indian or Senator Pocahontas.
That's right. Here in Texas, we got Robert O'Rourke, who is a trans Hispanic. This guy calls himself Beto. I mean, this guy is not Hispanic in any way, shape, or form. He didn't marry a Hispanic. I mean, how fraudulent can you be? I mean, identity politics is despicable, but what's even more despicable is to use it like Elizabeth Warren and like O'Rourke are using it to pretend that they're Indian or pretend that they're Hispanic so they can get an advantage.
And in the end, it won't help. But while I got a minute, If people need to understand the dire consequences, even if you have a loser senator like a McCaskill or a Collins, if we lose the Senate, if we lose the House, then all of these committees flip, and we'll have zero power there, and we're going to see censorship coming down on the internet like we can't imagine. They just signaled how the new censorship trick is going to be. What they've done to James Woods, which is interfering in elections. Today, a joke meme can be banned on social media because it's interfering with elections. This is a signal of things to come, and we need to be really watching out for this. I've been banned 6 times for a month on Facebook in the last year for posting just memes that are just general memes. Don't say anything bad, but I posted a meme, people can see it on my Twitter, pinned on top of my Twitter, that just put two news stories together. And by putting two news stories together, it was called hate speech, even though there was no speech. So if we don't get control of social media, and there are some exciting new developments coming out that, you know, will be unfolding and coming out over the next days and weeks, but we need to control our own YouTube, our own Facebook, our own Twitter, our own Patreon, and not depend on, you know, going hat in hand to the corporations that hate us, you know, to be allowed the scraps at their table. We need our own platform, and this is going to be coming out in the near future. So everybody stay tuned. That's all I can say.
Okay, so you've got some information on the inside other than what we saw from Tim Berners-Lee over the weekend talking about Internet 2.0. You're talking about some other platforms.
That's almost at a theoretical level at this point. I'm talking about social media platforms, and you know, Minds and Gab are okay as far as they go, but when you only have one element of, say, the four or five major elements of internet freedom, if you don't control, if you only have a competing Twitter, it's going to be shut down like, you know, the antibodies rush to it to surround an invading organism. You know, it'll be blockaded and censored as, you know, a hate site or whatever. But if we have our own way to upload to our own YouTube that we control, friendly libertarian conservatives controlling our own YouTube space, our own Patreon space, our own Facebook space, our own Skype space, all within one under one roof, controlled in friendly hands, that's what's going to be unfolding, and I'd like to come back and talk about it at some point. It's not up to me right now to make any announcements, but I'm inside of this situation.
Well, I think that's really where we're going to have our freedom happen. I mean, it's going to be measures, it's going to be countermeasures, it's going to be a continuing war. Because it is an information war. You know, we just had, in California, we just had that Senator Pan who pushed mandatory vaccines. He just got his mandatory censorship bill shut down by, of all people, Jerry Brown. But, of course, Jerry Brown couldn't say, well, you can't do this because we've got a First Amendment. No, he had said, well, we don't need it. It's not necessary. At least it was shut down, even if he didn't do it for the right reason. But that's the kind of authoritarianism that we're seeing from people in the Democrat Party. And I think that guy, Pan, in California, has got a big career ahead of him inside the National Democrat Party.
There's so much censorship going on when we can see how InfoWars on the same day was banned by most of these platforms, you know, in a coordinated effort, and then Twitter. But even when you're on Twitter, you can see what happened to James Woods, or in my case, they just dial your volume down from 100 to, I have like something like 15,000 followers, and if I do the most killer meme of all time, it gets 10 retweets, because people tell me they have to go to my timeline, they have to type in my name to see what I'm posting. My posts do not just show up on their timeline if you follow me. And this is what they do to conservatives. And my analogy is, free social media is a sucker game where we're the guinea pigs that are following a trail of poisoned rabbit pellets into their trap, into their infernal machine. They say it's free, but they're selling the contents of our minds. They're data mining our privacy, our friends, our acquaintances, our relationships, what we buy, what websites we go to, is crunched on supercomputers and then sold to corporations. And it's also saved for later use by a tyrannical government, which will have the tools to say, who are the 100 people we should get rid of if we do it quietly? Or who are the 10,000 we need to silence? So these tools are in the future going to be turned against us. That's why we need our own comprehensive social media structure where we control the message, not Zuckerberg, Jack Dorsey, Google, etc. And this is going to be coming.
Or President Xi, because we already see this happening in China with their social media credits. And then as we're reporting on that, it wasn't even a month and we started finding out, well, Facebook
Operation
has got one,
Dragonfly.
Apple's got one.
Yeah.
Dragonfly. And so, you know, first we talked about how it was happening in China, and then it's like, oh, it's happening here in the U.S. already. But, of course, don't worry. They're not going to use that for political purposes. It's like baloney. They're not going to use it for
they
political purposes.
They already are.
Go back and look at PRISM. You know, that's been going on since 2007. It was shown with the Snowden leaks and many other things that they're doing.
It's not an overt social credit system yet where they deny you a job or a house. But it might as well be when your message is dialed down and other messages are amplified. It's overtly political to tilt Google's search results, etc. is very political. And
you know,
we need to get control of it.
They've just had this situation in India with their Aadhaar system. And, of course, that is means foundation in their language. They're not using it as a stick right now. They're using it as a carrot. But it is the foundation for that kind of tyranny. Thank you so much for joining us. Matt Bracken, you can find him on Twitter, MattBracken48. His website, enemiesforeignanddomestic.com.
In Texas, it's David Knight.
Welcome back. We were just talking to Matt Bracken, of course, about this extension for another week so the FBI can do some more investigating. And, of course, they're going to be investigating allegations by Christine Blasey Ford. After how many hours of talking about this, 8 or 9 hours, what else can be said that hasn't already been said? Now, they're going to also talk to Ramirez, who made another allegation after spending 6 days with her lawyer. I now remember clearly what happened decades ago, she said. Well, we'll see how well she remembers this. And, of course, if it wasn't for the political bias, this would be a very dangerous thing for her to do. But we've seen that they're very, very selective about who they bring perjury charges against. I mean, if she was a Republican talking about this, remember General Flynn? Remember how they entrapped him? Remember how dangerous it is to tell a lie to an FBI agent? But, of course, she should be able to do this without any problem. Her lawyer, who had coached her into these recollections, I believe, a guy who was a politically elected as a Democrat in Colorado. Her lawyer, I think, wisely said she's not going to be testifying to Congress. She's not going to go under oath. If you want to know what she has to say, just read the New Yorker. And again, it was in the New Yorker that the New York Times said, we don't think, the New York Times doesn't think that Ramirez is credible. But now we're going to delay this for another week so the FBI can do their thing. The New York Times said, we talked to a dozen witnesses, and we don't believe that what she had to say was credible. Ronan Farrow was even questioned by George Stephanopoulos, and when he was questioned, he defended running with this story and even put in the fact that she had to think about this with her lawyer for 6 days. They went over that. Okay, yeah, okay. That's the way I now remember it and so forth. He said she was being pressured by the Democrats. She was being backed into a corner by the Democrats. So we decided to go out and tell her side of the story before they started putting information out there. This whole thing is a political operation. And what we're seeing here with this FBI investigation is a delay tactic. Now, we're going to have President Trump is going to be making a statement about NAFTA soon. And we're going to go to that live when that begins, because now we have NAFTA 2.0. At the last minute, as I pointed out, we had Justin Trudeau essentially throw some of his dairy farmers and other people under the bus to get an agreement on this. Now, they've renamed it the United States-Mexico-Canada Agreement, USMCA, instead of NAFTA. But the Mexican negotiator is calling it NAFTA 2.0. And Trudeau and company are saying that we had to preserve the trilateral nature of this agreement, the superstructure of this, at all costs. So he was willing, I believe, for short-term gain, short-term loss, to throw even his own people under the bus. And let me tell you why this is the case, why this is so important. There is an article in USA Today about what is NAFTA and so forth. Well, you know what NAFTA is if you've listened to this program. But they say this: can the U.S. exit NAFTA if no deal is reached? In other words, kind of like Brexit, could there be a Nexit, a NAFTA exit? Well, they say under NAFTA, Article 2205, any party to the agreement could withdraw 6 months after providing written notice. Oh, sounds very much like Brexit, doesn't it? Time frame is different, 6 months instead of, what was it, year and a half, 2 years, I don't know what it was. But you got to provide written notice that we're going to withdraw. But even then, the U.S.'s obligations under NAFTA would not necessarily end. That's interesting, isn't it? They think they've got us, and maybe they do. This is the thing that really concerns me. Just like we can always celebrate whenever there is a tax cut, we still look at the spending bills. And we say, if you're going to cut taxes and then you're going to increase spending, this is a short-term prescription for relief, but it is a long-term disaster. That is my fear of NAFTA 2.0. No matter what you call it, we have left this structure in place. What we needed was a Nexit, NAFTA exit.
It's the real news. Live from the Infowars.com studios in Austin, Texas, it's your host, David Knight.
Welcome back. I'm David Knight. We have President Trump about to speak on the new trade agreement. As NAFTA was about to expire last night, getting right up to the very end, again, President Trump triangulated this situation, coming up with a bilateral agreement with Mexico. And everybody was saying, but what about NAFTA? I mean, can you have a bilateral agreement with this? Well, he put pressure on Justin Trudeau to throw something in, and he did. He threw in dairy, some changes in terms of dairy, because they had escalated the import restrictions to the extent that it had pretty much shut off any exports from the U.S. for dairy into Canada. So this is something that the Canadian dairy farmers are very angry about. They said, well, he's betrayed about 250,000 dairy farmers here. But he said, don't worry, we'll pay for that. He is willing to do anything to preserve the trilateral nature of this agreement. And I think we need to take a look at what is going on in Europe to really put this into proper context. As I said at the top of the hour, is this really going to help us in the long term? Yes, it absolutely is going to help us in the short term. And yes, it was a masterstroke of manipulation by President Trump. We see this also happening in China. China kept saying, well, we're going to match your tariffs tit for tat. And yet President Trump said, I've got a kitty here of over $800 billion per year in terms of a deficit that you're taking away from us. In other words, he's got $800 billion to throw away there. And there's no way that they're going to win with that. And so now we see some capitulation from China as well. China has slashed steel and textile tariffs as Trump is ratcheting up pressure. Now, this is a clear win, I believe. China's finance ministry announced Sunday that it will reduce import tariffs on a variety of products, including textiles and steel. The tariff rate for textiles and metals, including steel, will fall to 8.4% from the current 11.5% effective November the 1st, reports Reuters. They said average tariffs across 1,500 products will reach 7.8%, down from 10.5%. The reductions come as President Trump deploys increasingly aggressive tariffs against Chinese goods, and just 6 days after Trump implemented a 10% tariff on $200 billion worth of Chinese goods, following a similar action against $50 billion worth of goods in August. It's not the first time that China has reduced trade barriers amidst Trump's criticism. In July, they lowered tariffs on consumer goods, including clothing and home appliances. In other words, Trump knows that he is holding all the cards. He's literally said, I'm holding all the cards. And he's got the Trump card on this, and he's wisely using that and getting concessions on that in China. But you have to understand that the trilateral nature of this is very, very important to the globalists. Where is the most active defense of globalism taking place right now? In the European Union. As I pointed out earlier in the program, the foreign affairs minister of France announced a plan during a speech at Harvard University suggesting that Europe should align itself with countries like India, Australia, Mexico, and other powerful democracies that share a commitment to multilateralism. The one thing that they cannot have is a bilateral agreement between the U.S. and Mexico and a second bilateral agreement between the U.S. and Canada. Cannot have that happen. We must, at all costs, they think, preserve this supranational agreement, whatever you call it, whether you call it NAFTA or whether you call it the USMCA. And as I said at the top of the hour, can we get out of NAFTA? Can we shut it down? Under the NAFTA Article 2205, any party to the agreement could withdraw within 6 months after providing written notice, but even then, the U.S.'s obligations under NAFTA would not necessarily end. This is very similar to Brexit. Once you create these supranational organizations that begin to exercise control over your economy, and of course, this was a key aspect that you had Trudeau pushing for as he was doing this negotiation. As they were talking about this wonderful new trade agreement, Trudeau was saying that, and celebrating the trilateral agreement, that was what the Mexican president was saying, Trudeau was saying that Canada agreed to eliminate a recent milk ingredient pricing program. The farmers had complained, had dried up their demand for this because it was important for them to maintain this supranational agreement. That was the key thing. And so, when we look at this, that is what he threw the farmers under the bus for there in Canada to keep this going. And that is what they're trying to do in Europe as well. The French foreign minister told the Associated Press he believes the United States methodically and regularly jeopardizes the fundamentals of multilateralism through its approach to the UN, through trade deals, and other international agreements. They're very, very concerned that these structures that they put in place not be taken out. And so that means that we have something that structurally is going to threaten our sovereignty down the road. In the same way that it's a good thing we have tax cuts, but when we don't have that accompanied by spending cuts, what that does is that puts us more in the control of the central bankers. Merkel is also fighting for globalism. She warns Trump against destroying the United Nations. She warned yesterday that President Trump should not destroy the United Nations. I believe that destroying something without having developed something new is extremely dangerous. Well, President Trump was saying we've got sovereignty. That's maybe a new thing, right? That would be a new thing. We haven't had that in over a generation for 60, 70 years. She added that she believed multilateralism was a solution to many of the world's problems. No, it hasn't been. It has been the source of the biggest problems that the world has, this mass migration and the transfer of wealth from the first world to China. In his second appearance before the UN's annual gathering last week, Trump told the General Assembly that he and his administration reject the ideology of globalism. We embrace the doctrine of patriotism. Trump said that global governance is a form of coercion and domination that responsible nations must defend against. And what are the globalists defending against? What is France and Germany? Because they are the ones who are trying to establish themselves. They're kind of competing for the leadership of this European Union. As Zero Hedge is pointing out, Pepe Escobar, actually, history may one day rule that this was the fateful geopolitical moment when the European Union clinched its PhD on foreign policy. What is he saying? Well, he's saying that they have come up with a structure that will basically allow them to shut down U.S. sanctions and the weaponizing of the U.S. dollar. And they're doing it through something that they call a special purpose vehicle. Last week, EU foreign policy head Federica Mogherini, an Iranian foreign minister, announced at the UN a special purpose vehicle, an SPV, to deal with the Trump administration's sanctions on Iran after the U.S. unilaterally pulled out of the Iran nuclear deal. They said this means that EU member states will set up a legal entity to facilitate legitimate financial transactions with Iran, and this will allow European countries to continue to trade with Iran in accordance with European Union law and could be open to other partners in the world. Remember when President Trump said that NATO and the NATO countries weren't doing their job, that they were working against the U.S., that they were maybe harming us more than some of the stated enemies? That's what these people are doing now. And so what they're doing is they're creating a shell structure. And evidently, I guess these to avoid sanctions with the U.S., some of the largest companies in Europe had contracts with Iran that were going to be affected by these Iranian sanctions. So presumably, they would be able to trade with this shell institution that is being set up by our friends in Brussels, the European Union. And by doing so, they would be able to say, well, we're not dealing directly with Iran. And so you can't punish our country for selling to Iran. We're selling to this SPV. And then the European Union is setting that up not just for European countries, but for other countries too, to try to take away the weaponizing of the U.S. dollar. And of course, that is undermining the petrodollar in that foreign policy. Stay with us. We'll be right back. President Trump is going to be talking about NAFTA 2.0. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm David Knight, and we're about to go live to President Trump talking about the NAFTA agreement as we're waiting for him to begin speaking. As I always said, all the headlines in a Trump win, Canada and U.S. deal saves NAFTA as a trilateral pact. And I read for you the Bloomberg story where they repeatedly talk about the importance of maintaining it as a trilateral structure. And this article from Politico talks about how Canada agreed to eliminate a recent milk ingredient pricing program that U.S. farmers had complained had dried up demand for the exports of their product. In exchange, Canada was able to preserve dispute settlement language that Canada has historically insisted on in an international panel to judge whether the U.S. improperly uses duties as a commercial weapon. That is the essence of the loss of sovereignty. The fact that we have these supranational panels where corporations are treated equally to countries or to other government structures. We just had Tesla sue complain under this agreement that Ontario had cut back on their electric car subsidies. And this is the type of thing that is not allowed under this supranational agreement. And so that has been preserved along with the trilateral nature of it. But here is President Trump speaking about NAFTA 2.0, as he calls it, USMCA.
And that'll be the name, I guess, that 99% of the time we'll be hearing, USMCA. Has a good ring to it. I have long contended that NAFTA was perhaps the worst trade deal ever made. Since NAFTA's adoption, the United States racked up trade deficits totaling more than $2 trillion. And it's a much higher number than that. With Canada and Mexico, it lost vast amounts of money and lost 4.1 million manufacturing jobs and one in four auto jobs. It lost about 25% of our auto jobs, even more than that. Throughout the campaign, I promised to renegotiate NAFTA, and today we have kept that promise. But for 25 years as a civilian, as a businessman, I used to say, how could anybody have signed a deal like NAFTA? And I watched New England and so many other places where I was, just the factories were leaving, the jobs were leaving, people were being fired, and we can't have that. So we have negotiated this new agreement based on the principle of fairness and reciprocity. To me, it's the most important word in trade because we've been treated so unfairly by so many nations all over the world that we're changing that. We just signed a much better deal with South Korea. We had a horrible, horrible deal, and we just signed that at United Nations, and that's worked out well, and they're happy, we're happy. It's good for jobs, good for a lot of things. When that deal was signed, they said 250,000 jobs will be given by signing this transaction. And they were right. I've said it before. They were right. 250,000 jobs to South Korea, not to the United States. So that's changed and very much for the better. And this one is a brand new deal. The agreement will govern nearly $1.2 trillion in trade, which makes it the biggest trade deal in the United States history. I want to congratulate U.S. Trade Representative Bob Lighthizer, who has worked. Nobody understands how hard he's worked. No matter when you called him, he was in the office, or he was in somebody else's office doing the same thing. Hey, Bob Lighthizer is great. I've heard it for years. I said, if I ever do this, I want to get Lighthizer to represent us, because he felt the way I did. And the entire team at the USTR standing behind me and some right here in the audience. I want to thank you all. Fantastic job. Peter Navarro, everybody. Thank you all. Thank you. Fantastic group of people. They love our country. I also want to thank Secretary Mnuchin, Secretary Ross, Secretary Nielsen, Secretary Perdue, Jared Kushner, Peter Navarro, and the United States Ambassador to Canada, Kelly Craft. Thank you. Thank you, Kelly. Thank you. Thank you. I also want to thank President Peña Nieto of Mexico, who we had a few disagreements, but I really like him a lot. I think he may like me, I'm not sure. But I think he's a terrific person, and he'll be leaving soon, but he's really done a good job and wonderful, wonderful person. And the Mexican president-elect, López Obrador, who has given his support to this agreement, and we're developing a really good relationship, which I think is very important for our country, frankly, and for Mexico. And so they worked together on this. This was done by both. I said, look, I don't want to sign an agreement. And then a new president comes in. They don't like it. And we have difficulty. They work very much together on it. And I appreciate it from both. I have to certainly give my highest regards to Prime Minister of Canada, Justin Trudeau. A lot of stories came out about Justin and I having difficulty together, and we did over the trade deal. But I'll tell you, it's turned out to be a very, very good deal for both and a very, very good deal for all three. It puts us in a position that we've never been in before. It's very good when you look at the world and what the world is doing, and what when you look at the unfair trade practices that countries are using against the United States. This is a terrific deal for all of us. Once approved by Congress, this new deal will be the most modern, up-to-date, and balanced trade agreement in the history of our country, with the most advanced protections for workers ever developed. If you look at the reviews, people that would normally not, under any circumstances, say good things, because automatically they have to say bad. Even some Democrats say, that's amazing. We had some, they haven't been given the sound bites yet, I guess, Mike. But actually, you had some Democrats say, this is really amazing if he really got all of that. But by tomorrow, I would suspect they'll change their tune. But that's okay, because people know how good it is. It's an amazing deal for a lot of people. Likewise, it will be the most advanced trade deal in the world, with ambitious provisions on the digital economy, patents, very important, financial services, and other areas where the United States has a strong competitive advantage. Mexico and Canada have agreed to strong new labor protections, environmental protections, and new protections for intellectual property. So important. This new deal is an especially great victory for our farmers. Our farmers have gone through a lot over the last 15 years. They've been taken advantage of by everybody. Prices have gone way down. And we're working on some other deals that are going to make them very happy also. But this is a very, very big deal for our farmers. Mexico and Canada will be opened up a lot more than they are now. And I think there'll be a better spirit between the three countries, which is important for our farmers. The agreement will give our farmers and ranchers far greater access to sell American
grown. All right, we've got to take a break. We'll be back. That's President Trump talking about NAFTA. And, of course, the trilateral aspect of that has been retained, along with the international panel that will determine whether or not we trade. That's free trade. Okay, we'll be right back.
Waging information warfare against pushers of fake news. It's David Knight.
Here we had Michael Caputo weigh in on these calls for an FBI investigation. Of course, he is an advisor, a GOP advisor. And he had an interesting comparison between the focus of the FBI on this Kavanaugh hearing and the attention that they gave to Hillary Clinton. And I cannot get over the fact that, you know, we saw her get away with Benghazi. And of course, you know, the Democrats are fine if you've got a few military guys get cut off and stranded and left to die. They're okay with that. But evidently, you know, the U.S. military typically has a code. You don't leave people behind. But that doesn't seem to be the case with the CIA, because they're not really concerned about what Hillary Clinton did to people who are working with the CIA. That has set up a troubling example for anybody that is thinking of working with the CIA, anybody who's a foreign national. What she did in terms of her tenure, allowing that information to get out, and of course, during her tenure, and it ended when she was no longer there. During her tenure, the Chinese had embedded some code in her not-so-private server. Yes, it was private in one sense, but it was public knowledge to any state actors, and they had a receipt of every email that she received and sent, and during that time, they rounded up many Chinese spies that were working with the CIA, and they executed them. And of course, the CIA doesn't really seem to care. The deep state doesn't want to get justice for that. They don't want to make a case out of that. I mean, that would be a signal to people abroad if you wanted to try to get somebody to work for you as doing human intelligence in another country. It's like, we're going to treat it seriously if somebody betrays you. But of course, Hillary Clinton can betray the Americans here in this country. She can betray the Constitution, and she can betray people who are working for the CIA as foreign nationals, and she gets away with it. But here's what Michael Caputo had to say about the difference in the way the FBI is going to investigate Kavanaugh and the way they investigated Hillary Clinton.
I've been hearing for a week about how Clarence Thomas's FBI investigation only took 3 days, and we all know that the FBI looked at 650,000 of Hillary Clinton's emails in just 24, 36 hours, so it'll just take a week. But when he is confirmed, if he is, I'm concerned. We see, you know, social media accounts associated with Black Lives Matter talking about how they're going to riot. So that is apparently where we're going from here.
Mm. All right, Michael Caputo.
And, of course, President Trump makes the obvious statement. It'll never be enough for them. He said, wow, just starting to hear the Democrats who are only thinking obstruct and delay. They're starting to put out the word that the time and scope of the FBI looking into Judge Kavanaugh and the witnesses is not enough. They don't even know what it's going to be yet, but it's already not enough. A week is not enough. Just a couple of days for Hillary Clinton and her tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of emails, and that was not a problem. But for, and of course, it was her lawyers who decided what they would turn over to the FBI. What kind of an investigation is that? Sorry, you can't see that. We'll let you know what you can see and what you can investigate. We'll let you know. We'll get back to you. But anyway, they're already saying it's not going to be enough of an investigation for Kavanaugh. He says for them, it'll never be enough. Just stay tuned and watch. Chuck Grassley, meanwhile, sends a blistering letter, as a Daily Caller headline puts it, to Bernie Sanders, who is demanding an FBI investigation into Kavanaugh. And he writes to Chuck Grassley writes to Bernie Sanders, who publicly announced his decision to oppose Kavanaugh's confirmation less than 24 hours after he was nominated. He said, your public statements, Bernie Sanders, clearly reveal how unimportant it is to you to review any facts related to this nomination. So you can imagine my surprise at receiving your letter regarding the supplemental FBI background investigation. Because, of course, he said, I don't really care what the facts are. I'm not going to support him at all. Within 24 hours, he said, not voting for him, not voting for him. So why would you need to do an investigation, Bernie? He said, this supplemental background investigation by the FBI was requested by undecided members of both parties. But I am to take from your letter that you are now undecided and that you are now willing to seriously engage with the Senate's advice and consent, constitutional duties related to the nomination of Judge Kavanaugh to serve as an associate justice. If so, we should have a conversation about what information you need to assist you in making a decision. And I look forward to that conversation. In other words, he knows. Bernie Sanders came out within 24 hours, and now he pretends he's undecided and he needs to have an FBI investigation. Let's play the clip from Joe Biden 27 years ago. We had a similar situation with Clarence Thomas and Anita Hill. And Joe Biden said this to all the people who were demanding an FBI investigation. I'll play this again. While the Democrats are pretending that they really need to have that FBI investigation.
The last thing I'll point out, the next person that refers to an FBI report as being worth anything obviously doesn't understand anything. FBI explicitly does not, in this or any other case, reach a conclusion. Period. Period. So, Judge, there's no reason why you should know this. The reason why we cannot rely on the FBI report, you wouldn't like it if we did, because it is inconclusive. They say he said, she said, and they said, period. So when people wave an FBI report before you, understand, they do not reach conclusions. They do not make, as my friend points out more adequate, they do not make recommendations.
And so we're going to have an investigation, nevertheless, now of Christine Blasey Ford. After hours upon hours of testimony and cross-examination, we're now going to have the FBI write down what she said again, just so that they can delay this. And they're also going to take a look at Ramirez, the woman who needed 6 days with her Democrat lawyer to decide what her story was going to be, and then refused to testify under oath, referring people to the New Yorker article by Ronan Farrow that even the New York Times said was not valid. Even the New York Times didn't believe that. And so now they are saying that they're going to talk to Ramirez. Ramirez's lawyer confirmed that she would cooperate with the investigation, but declined to comment further. We can confirm that the FBI has reached out to interview Mrs. Ramirez, and she has agreed to cooperate with our investigation. So we'll see what happens with that. Meanwhile, we are supposed to believe, according to Mazie Hirono and Gerald Nadler, that Brett Kavanaugh, even if he is confirmed, should recuse himself from cases involving Democrats. Gerald Nadler said, I think the proper thing would be yes. I was astonished at this rant. He is supposed to be nonpartisan, but he talked about the Clintons. Imagine that. His animus toward the entire Democrat Party, toward people associated with it, like the Clintons, should be disqualifying. He shows no judicial temperament. Well, what would they, did they have those same concerns about the appointments made by Barack Obama to the Supreme Court, where he had the lady who had been spearheading Obamacare, and she was put into a Supreme Court decision as that was coming before the court, that very issue? That is a major issue. Everybody, Republican and Democrat, agrees that Obamacare is a major issue. And yet here she was the Obama point person for pushing Obamacare ahead, and she didn't recuse herself from deciding on Obamacare, Elena Kagan. And we've got others, like I just said, Bernie Sanders, within 24 hours of hearing about the nomination, said, I'm not going to vote for him, now pretending that he is undecided. Now you got Mazie Hirono and Gerald Nadler saying he should recuse himself from anything involving the Democrats because he had the audacity to point out that this is nothing other than a political circus, a political sideshow that Feinstein had set on this stuff for months as they were scheming behind the scenes with George Soros lawyers to keep this going. And so in that context, you angrily point out how your character and your life is being assassinated. So that says that you don't have judicial temperament. I think it shows that he's got integrity that I never knew he had before. Because we've got Kamala Harris saying that Brett Kavanaugh's nomination to the Supreme Court is a direct threat to Roe v. Wade, protecting a woman's right to choose. The American people deserve better than this. Sign our petition, oppose his nomination to the Supreme Court. It is all political, folks. It's a shame that that's what the Supreme Court has become, but it is.
The greetings of people in trouble, reflections of my life.
Oh, how they fill my eyes. Welcome back. I want to get into some more of the backstory of this Kavanaugh stuff that has surfaced over the weekend. And before we do, real quickly, and before we get into what's happening here in Texas, some interesting updates on both the Texas race and the race for governor in Florida, because both of those have a common element. Surprise, surprise, George Soros and millions of dollars from he and other billionaires on the left pushing a progressive agenda using identity politics at the surface. And of course, it doesn't matter if you don't have any identity politics like Robert O'Rourke, you can appropriate them. You can call yourself Hispanic, the trans-Hispanic. And so we're going to get into that in just a moment. We had an interesting development yesterday in terms over the weekend in terms of the debate. Before we do, real quickly, if you want to support the program here and what we do, we have a special offer for those listeners of this program. Just for this program, we have the coupon code REALNEWS to get 15% off of the ProPure King water filtration system. That is the large gravity feed water filtration system, and you can save 15% off that, big savings, with the code REALNEWS at checkout. We also at InfoWarsStore.com have BrainForce Plus, 40% off. Secret 12, our vitamin B12 formula, 40% off. Both Super Male and Super Female Vitality, 50% off. And finally, our final run of Survival Shield X2 Nascent Iodine, 25% off while supplies last. Take a look at the products we have at InfoWarsStore.com. That's what we use to support this program, and it can support your health, your family's health, and free speech at the same time. You know, it's kind of interesting as we're looking at the hypocrisy of people like Dianne Feinstein and others. We had over the weekend a DOD whistleblower coming out and saying that Dianne Feinstein covered up sexual assault in 1990 because it was committed against her, not against Dianne Feinstein, but against this whistleblower, Sharon Bovat. She put up a couple of videos on YouTube making the allegations. And this was covered up in 1990 by Dianne Feinstein, the same person who was covering up the fact that she had an allegation that was going to be released at the last minute while she was making preparations for lawyers from the Democrat establishment and everything to come against Kavanaugh. On Friday, Sharon Bovat, a self-described DOD whistleblower, said she was sexually assaulted by a big donor to Senator Dianne Feinstein in 1990 when Feinstein was running for governor of California. She said in 1990, she was at the Feinstein party of a Japanese investor at the Fairmount Hotel in San Francisco. Feinstein was running for governor. It was her 47th birthday. After the dinner, Sharon went up to her room and was molested and sexually abused by the Japanese donor. The next day, she was kicked out of the hotel. Sharon's mother was a Democrat and a friend of Dianne Feinstein. Sharon said she was never going to go public until Feinstein began her awful smear of Brett Kavanaugh. Which may be why you have this story. A lot of people are talking about how they are going to vote red for the first time. They're fed up with what's going on. Internet explodes with Democrats saying that they'll be voting all red for the first time ever. A poll finds a majority of West Virginia voters. This spells trouble for Manchin, who is running for re-election up there. Of course, that's Trump country. Poll finds majority of West Virginia voters want Kavanaugh confirmed. And we have in Missouri, Claire McCaskill, who is already in trouble, has now announced that she will oppose Kavanaugh. And her opponent, Josh Hawley, the Republican, has taken the lead over Claire McCaskill in Missouri. I think this is energizing the Republican base. I think they're seeing a blowback against this. And there may be a blowback against those that are committing false witness against Kavanaugh. Grassley has referred an accuser who at first was anonymous through Sheldon Whitehouse's office. He made an anonymous call through the senator from Rhode Island, Sheldon Whitehouse, and he made allegations of a rape on a boat in August of 1985. And these are allegations that were not firsthand accounts, of course. This is allegations that he had raped a woman. And so this is hearsay. And this is going back to 1985. And what happened was this was all going to be anonymous, but then the guy's name got out. And as soon as his name got out, he recanted. And he recanted over Twitter after they released a transcript of the call. He said, everyone who's going crazy about what I said, I have recanted it because I've made a mistake. And I apologize for such a mistake. Now, CNN ran the story over an hour after he had tweeted that out, over an hour after he had said, it's not real, it didn't happen. CNN was still running the story. And it took them 3 hours later before they updated their story to include the backpedaling. Now, this is where it gets interesting, because Grassley said in his letter, when individuals provide fabricated allegations to the committee, diverting committee resources during time-sensitive investigations, it materially impedes our work. Such acts are not only unfair, they are potentially illegal. It is illegal to make materially false, fictitious, or fraudulent statements to congressional investigators, and it is illegal to obstruct committee investigations. That is very important because we have a lot of very unusual allegations being made, a lot of them anonymous, and a lot of these are coming from people like Avenatti and his client, Julie Swetnick, who we now see was herself accused of sexual misconduct at a Portland company. This just gets more and more amazing as we go through all this. And I think one of the reasons that they're doing that, they have to get serious and they have to come after these people who are making false allegations. Because if they don't, they are going to run this clock out. I mean, this is, they're back and forth. They're dribbling. You know, we've seen this all happen in the basketball games. They get 1 point ahead and they just start passing the ball back and forth and dribbling in the backcourt, running the clock out. And that's what this is. This is a constant dribble, dribble, dribble of allegations. And if they don't get serious about this, you're going to continue to have these. We had another one surface last night. A Yale friend says Kavanaugh was a heavy drinker. And he said, while another one is saying there was no sexual misconduct, I would remember that. So It's amazing to see these back and forth allegations that are happening. And as Brett Kavanaugh said in his testimony, there is a bright red line between drinking or even drinking heavily and sexual assault. But now we have a Yale friend who came out last night at the last minute and says he wants to be interviewed by the FBI. If they don't get serious about these baseless allegations and start prosecuting some of these people over this stuff, then this is going to go on forever and they will run the clock out. We had the leader of North Carolina's Republican Party said that one of the women who has publicly accused Supreme Court nominee Kavanaugh of sexual misconduct is a criminal. He said she's a criminal one way or the other. She, Julie Swetnick, she either was a part of some massive criminal conspiracy to facilitate child rape as an adult, or more likely she lied to Congress and her attorney knew it. She should go to prison, period. And again, this is Avenatti's accuser who said that there was gang rape, that he was part of a group of high school students when she was in college, and that they were drugging women, getting them drunk, and then raping them. But of course, she went to 10 of these parties. So she's continually going to these parties. She is older, and she is evidently, according to her testimony, was knowing that this stuff was going on and not blowing the whistle on it, but participating in it. And that's why the leader of North Carolina's Republican Party said either if she's telling the truth, she is a criminal, and she is part of a conspiracy to facilitate child rape. In other words, statutory rape of underage kids when she was older than they were and doing it multiple times, 10 times. Or more likely, she is a liar and should be prosecuted for perjury. Now, I said I was going to talk about what's happening here in Texas. I think I've only got time just to, and Florida, I've only got time to go over what happened here in Texas. We're seeing massive registration, new registration here for the first time in Texas. We've seen the voter rolls increase by 1.6 million voters since the 2014 election. Nearly 400,000 voters have registered since March. Nothing to be concerned about, right? I'm sure that these are all legitimate voters. Nothing suspicious about that at all, right? Except that when you take a look at, let's do play this. I think we got enough time. Roll this commercial that O'Rourke was filming. He said he had something better to do than to debate Ted Cruz. And here's apparently what he was doing during that time.
Off. Got it. There's also a very large cat roaming this house. So if you see it jump up, yeah, he's out. Okay.
So initially, Cruz had to postpone this debate. Within an hour of postponing the debate, he had to postpone it because the vote was going to be held on Kavanaugh. But then they found out there was going to be a delay on it. So he came back within the hour and said, no, let's do the debate. He says, no, I'm busy. Well, what he was busy doing was cutting live, took a half-hour Facebook live stream, and four attempts to try to film a 30-second commercial. That was what he had to do that was better than debating Ted Cruz. All right, that's it for our program. Thanks for joining. Info.